The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, we're on Amazon, we're on Stitcher, and other podcast platforms under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. We are on Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. Barbara has a website, penonfire.com. Where you can find information about past shows, upcoming shows. She's got speaker series events that are still on Zoom, but they're happening pretty regularly. You can find out about those there. My website is mariestone.com. You have archives of, I think it's been 23 years of past shows up there. Thousands of interviews you can search for. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. It's another morning of welcoming back favorite past guests. Whenever I see Joan Silber has a new book out, I get a little giddy. I've coined her method of combining the short story form into the novelistic structure. Maybe it's more like creating a novel within the short story structure. Anyway, I call it the Silber method, and I love getting a chance to talk about it. So that is what we're going to do today. Joan Silber is the author of 9 books of fiction. Her latest, Secrets of Happiness, came out last month. Her last novel, Improvement, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction and the Penn Faulkner Award. She was on the show with me in 2018 to talk about that. You can find that interview up in our archives. She also received the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story. Her other works of fiction include Fools, longlisted for the National Book Award and finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. She was on the show with that book with me in 2013. The Size of the World was a finalist for the LA Times Prize in Fiction, and Ideas of Heaven was a finalist for the National Book Award and Story Prize. She has also written Lucky Us, In My Other Life, and In the City. Her first book, Household Words, won the Penn Hemingway Award. She is the author of The Art of Time in Fiction, a study of how various writers have used time. Her list of accolades in publishing is long. The list of places she's published is longer than that. I'm not going to read it all, but she has taught fiction at Sarah Lawrence College for many years. She teaches at the Warren Wilson College MFA program, and she's taught at several other universities and summer writing workshops. Secrets of Happiness is published by Counterpoint. It will drive much of our discussion today. Joan, welcome back.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
So we talked first in 2013 and last in 2018, and obviously now it's 2021. And I love that the pace of novels and publishing is such that I can sort of drop in on a writer's life and an author's work in these various and varied points in history and our political and social evolution, which feels like it's happening so fast these days. But, you know, 2013 felt so vastly different than 2018, which seems so vastly different than now. And then I get these insightful check-ins from smart people along the way. So, you know, this past year shut inside has given us the opportunity, you know, whether we wanted it or not, for a lot of reflection, not only about the pandemic, but all kinds of other issues that are fodders for fiction, you know, economic inequality and racial inequality and all of that. So before we get into the book, I was wondering if that long pause of time was kind of creatively productive for you, kind of how the past year impacted your thoughts and thinking and how you've processed that.
I have liked the last year more than that. Obviously, I've not liked being in a terrible state of emergency and having tragedy around me, but I like staying in, and I think many writers do. So the enforcement of, you know, you have to be in your own house all the time was not terrible for us. I think the first few months were the hardest for everybody because you didn't know, can I go out? Can I do this? What's dangerous? What's not? You could barely get masks, certainly, the first few weeks, and they didn't know if you needed them or not. But once things got clarified, I felt like I formed new habits that are actually quite helpful for me. And I did get plenty of work done. So, I mean, I like best, you know, working at home at my desk. So I had, you know, as good a year as I would have, you know, trying to get things done.
Do you use your writing sort of as a way to process what people are going through, what you were going through? Like, did you feel like it was creatively an interesting time for you, or do you feel like it's kind of too soon to say?
I'm not sure that and what I'm working on now, there's certainly a mention of the era that we're in. It starts at that point, but it goes back in time pretty quickly. I'm not sure that I will write about it directly. you know, I have other things that I want to write about that seem to be taking priority.
Yeah, I'm always just wondering if, I think we talked about this a little bit last time, if in retrospect, you look back on things and say, oh, I can kind of see things in there. Maybe I didn't see as I was doing it, but you can kind of recognize things in hindsight almost. I'm finding that's true of a lot of things I look back on. I'm like, it's not directly in there. It's not, you know, I wasn't hitting it on point, but you can kind of see echoes of what I must have been thinking about. And I do wonder if it's going to seep out in ways like that.
I think because I've been answering lots of questions this past month, I think there's a certain amount of writing that's not so conscious. So sometimes people very kindly, you know, attribute to me these wise decisions, but in fact, I didn't exactly know why I was doing something. So I feel that that will be the same in terms of, you know, what thematic underpinnings are going on, you know, in what I'm working on now.
I think that's so true of most good writing. I think that some of the best writing, we're not really aware of what we're doing. The most interesting stuff comes out that way, I think. You're such a big traveler, I know. And so, you know, I was kind of wondering about that too, that kind of being shut inside. I think you used to travel, what, like twice a year, do two big trips a year?
Exactly. So that's been very frustrating. And I keep thinking, oh, maybe I'll get back to Asia, you know, in October. Well, no, maybe November, maybe December. It's, you know, of course, that keeps getting deferred. And that was difficult. And in fact, the one place in the book that I haven't been, usually the locales I cover are places I visited, but I meant to go to Nepal this past fall. And of course, I didn't get there. So I had to, you know, I had to read about it and ask people about it. But I also, because I live on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, I live on the edge of Chinatown. So one of the things that I did, because I didn't have a gym to use in my building anymore, is the city has placed near the East River, near where I live, it looks as if it's a kid's playground, but they're adult exercise machines that have been there for probably 20 years, very simple, you know, banged up metal machines. So I would go out there and use them in the mornings to get a little exercise. And right next to me would be a group doing a kind of Tai Chi with big red fans, sometimes a kind of Tai Chi with long, fabulous looking sabers. And then if I got there later, which I sort of usually do, there's a group that is doing ballroom dancing, which is apparently very popular in Beijing and Shanghai. And they would have a boombox playing fairly loudly, this, you know, kind of schmaltzy, you know, Chinese pop music, and they would be dancing to it. So I love that. That was my substitute for travel.
That's fantastic. I suppose if you have to be quarantined somewhere, New York is the best access you're going to get to sort of a cultural trip around the world, whether you intend it or not. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Have you been going to Asia most of your life, or was that kind of a concentrated period of time?
No, it's the past 20 years. In 01, I had been getting interested in Buddhism just on my own, as Americans do. And I saw there was a Buddhist trip to China, and I'd never been on a tour in my life. I thought tour groups were the dorkiest thing in the world, but this looked interesting. And in fact, that particular tour never left, as often happens to them. They didn't get enough people. But I looked up these other tours to China that were kind of backpacker tours. So they weren't fancy, which is more suitable to me. And I loved it. I went for 3 weeks to China in 01. And I thought, oh my God, I could just do this. I can sign up for things. I can do them. So, and of course, as I got better at it, I didn't always have to be with a tour group, but I did it both ways. And then friends wanted to go with me because they thought I knew how to do it. But my goal was to go to as many countries in Asia while I still could. And, you know, while I had the strength and the health and so forth. So because I was on an academic schedule at the time, I would try and go twice a year. So it's been 20 years of that travel.
So twice a year to some country in Asia?
Uh-huh.
And I would imagine that Asia has changed tremendously over the last 20 years. So I imagine that you're kind of able to dip in and see, you know, from an outsider's perspective, how much that part of the world has been changing.
The two places that I saw the most were, I went to Laos in 02, 03, and I went again maybe 4 years ago. And the capital of Vientiane of Laos is very changed. I mean, there's a highway along the Mekong now where there was not before, and it's much more, you know, citified and built up. And Bangkok was when I was there, a much more crowded, dense city than when I had first gone. And Chiang Mai too is more, but I don't know what it will be like now,
right?
Because the tourists have, of course, drained out of it. So it's it's all uncertain, and that is really interesting. I look forward to sort of seeing that.
That perspective, I wonder, as you have been watching events unfold here over the past year and violence against the Asian community, does that give you a different perspective on what's happening here?
It's pretty horrifying here. I mean, in sudden and, well, I suppose it's not so sudden. Our awareness of it is sudden. It's pretty disturbing.
Well, that's a good segue to get into the book. And before I have you introduce the book, I think it's just an interesting time to be having this kind of, you know, philosophical discussion of happiness. You know, I know the book was written pre-pandemic, so that's the nature of publishing. But what I do think a lot of us spent the last year reflecting on might not have been happiness per se, but kind of what makes our lives meaningful and how we want to spend our time and, you know, how mortality kind of defines and gives clarity to how we spend our time and what's important to us. So I thought, you know, that might have been a backdoor way of talking about happiness. But I think this conversation about how to get at happiness and the many, many ways these characters were struggling to do that, you know, whether it was through money or through relationships or through travel, it was just an interesting time to be having that conversation. And I thought maybe you could just kind of generally talk about what drew you to that big happiness theme before we dive into who the characters are.
I gave it the title Secrets of Happiness when I had finished the first chapter, and in which was published separately as a story. And that chapter involves a man discovers that his father has had for many years a whole other family with a woman from Thailand and her two sons who are living across town in Queens. He's in Manhattan. It was based on a friend had told me a real life story, which was that a woman she knew had discovered that her husband had another family and then went to travel to the very part of the world where the other woman was from. It was not Thailand. I made that up for myself. But what I thought was, it's about secrets, obviously. This guy has had this whole secret thing that the wife didn't have a clue about. And it's also about how the wife comes to another way of looking at, you know, she spends a year in Thailand and comes back pretty much with her feet on the ground. She's a fairly sensible person to begin with, but the broadening of travel really helps her. So she is the one who is starting to have the secrets to happiness. And the end of that chapter, her daughter is worried about money because the father has had this other family. And the mother says to the son, tell your sister not to worry. And that general sense that she has about things, that there's stuff to worry about and stuff not to, you know, was one of the things that I wanted to convey in the book. And that is sort of apt for now, certainly.
Yeah. Well, we talked about that last time, that one of the enduring themes of all of your work, as you observed, is this shift of characters who are, I don't know if naive is the word, but they have kind of a limited perspective on the world at the beginning, which then broadens either through life experience or travel or whatever it might be to, you know, have a bigger, more complex, more nuanced view of how things are. So it was fun having that conversation last time and then watching it play out in all of these stories, which I think was, an enduring theme.
Yes. I always see my people start off shallow and then they're right. Necessarily terrible and misguided, but they don't, naive is maybe a nicer word for it. And then the forces of life kind of take them towards a deeper sense of what's going on.
Right. So the book started with this first chapter was always the first chapter. Mm-hmm. And was that intended to, did you know that was going to be a book or you, did it start out as a short story intended to be just a short story?
I'm always sort of provisional about it. I mean, I certainly, my way of getting myself to do it is like, oh, it's just a story. You don't have to worry. You know, you're not marrying it. It's just a story, you know. And then if I feel that it has, you know, more to it, then I'll decide that it can be the jumping off point for something longer. I think I knew right away that I wanted to follow the second family, the Thai family. So, you know, I saw ways it could continue pretty early on.
Your method of writing is similar, I think, to kind of how I approach things too, which is plot is not really my strong suit. It's kind of hard for me. If you can enter things through character, I think it makes
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, I feel like it was a way I the last five books I've done in this mode, and it was a way I developed so that I mean, there are plenty of plot elements when I write, but they don't exactly form a conventional plot with a single line to it and a single rise to it. And it was a way of using, you know, what I was best at. you know, I my sense of characters was always, you know, that's what I wanted, you know, that's what I cared about most. And the way of showing, you know, how they each go through stuff without it being like a giant arc, but having each little sort of mini arc. And also, I got very attached to the idea that, you know, although my own life story is a big deal to me, it's a minor point in somebody else's. So I wanted to get that sense of it as well.
It's a little bit Elizabeth Stroudish. Is that a comparison you would enjoy?
I quite like her work, so I'm very happy with that. She has, I mean, her characters are more closely connected, you know, mine are all over. But the sense of following through and having each separate piece, certainly, yeah, I think she's a wonderful writer.
No, I think it's a wonderful way to, as you say, kind of, you know, make the world a little bit bigger when plot, you know, I think plot is often a way that you can make worlds bigger. But yeah, that's hard. So if you have characters coming at problems from all over the place, it's a wonderful way to do that. So one story, does kind of one story beget the next? So you knew, okay, I've started with Ethan and he's figured out this other family. And now I will go over to the other family and that will beget the next character. Mm-hmm. So it's not mapped out.
It's not mapped out. I knew that I wanted to somehow come back to Ethan in the end and something that had to do with the parents' marriage somewhere. But I didn't know more than that. But otherwise, I do. I make it up as I go along, and I like the way each piece helps generate the next one. There's a certain amount of messiness in that process. You know, I'll get ideas that don't work, you know, and they're discarded chapters in each book I've worked on. But I think that would be true anyway, whatever my method was. You know, no writer is that sure-footed that everything goes along perfectly.
Well, that's a problem I've been having. And I think maybe, you know, maybe this is a problem that people work this way have who don't typically outline, where it's very easy for me and other people I've observed in writing groups and whatnot to write 50 pages on a character and still not understand what the hell is happening. You know,
yes.
That something will happen. And if it does, then you kind of have to explain why it happened. And you can really get a ton of pages without having any material is almost how I would put it. And finding where the center of gravity is and, this is what the story is really about. This is what I was really trying to get at. I would normally say it takes time, but you know, it's new, I guess, every time you sit down to do it. And I don't know if it's something that can be taught, but it is an enduring problem. I mean, I just see people with 200 pages of kind of a mess at the end, you know, where every page is lovely. The sentences are great, but what does it add up to?
I think it's sort of about getting your character to a greater point of intensity, to putting enough pressure on the characters so that, because we all want to be surprised by our people, right? I mean, the writer does too. And so I think that, I mean, you have to give them a hard time.
Yeah.
Or get them tested in some way to get the story going. And certainly in all my years of teaching, that was something I found myself saying.
And you made the point that you have to do that without making it feel false, you know, that without having to say, oh, that, you know, I just threw this obstacle in and the reader can see what I'm doing. And I think that's tricky too, where, you know, I've had that experience as well, where I'm like, something has to happen here. And so, oh, he's going to have an affair. And then it, I don't know, there's a point at which it doesn't ring quite authentic, or it feels like, you know, you had to do this to make something happen. And maybe that's just a matter of doing it and revising it, and because your characters go through all of these things, but it never feels inevitable. I guess the surprising inevitability is what the tricky part is.
One thing that helps me when I'm in the invention stages, which are always the hardest for me, is if I have to research something. So, for instance, there's the character who has a childhood in Nepal, a place I hadn't been, so I have to keep reading about it. But I knew people who were like her parents. I mean, I understood what they would do and not do, sort of. And that helped me invent things. So some of the, and also I read what Kathmandu was like then, and I had a friend who was there who could tell me things. So I could, those gave me possibilities to play with and to practice on the characters. And that's, that you know, that helps, that keeps the thing going a lot of the time.
And I guess travel would help too. I mean, just the broad expanse of the number of places that the characters are coming from and their experiences in those places is generative material. I mean, I think that's another place where people can look to the exterior world to, you know, generate plot movement and pressure on the characters, as you say.
Yes.
I love that you have said, I have the soul of a miniaturist, you know, that you, right. You like these very close places. And I love that. I was wondering if there was a way, I guess we could talk a little bit more about these characters in general, but there's a wonderful character in here, Bud, who's kind of appears in the middle.
Oh, he's one of my favorite characters.
He's fantastic. And I was wondering if we could take that chapter, we could take any chapter, but kind of start with where you started mentally before you knew who this person was. He may have come to you from writing one of the other chapters, I imagine, so you must have had him a little bit in mind. But I would love to walk through your process of getting to know him, how you came to understand him, how you came to understand his backstory, and, you know, through the process of writing that chapter, maybe how your understanding of him may have changed, or we could walk through the Joan Silber process of writing.
All right. Well, I'd love to do that. He's mentioned in the chapter before. He's the Rachel, who's the main character in that story, the teller of it, has an old boyfriend who's now working in Cambodia for an NGO, and they start communicating together and sort of flirting by Skype. Just before Zoom. And that's all he's mentioned, except they like the conversations they have together. It's sort of going well. And they're both in their late 50s at that point. So it's a very latter day romance. And of course, a very safe one because they're far away. Cambodia is a place that has a lot of non-governmental organizations because it doesn't have a government that puts pressure against them as countries that are ostensibly communist, like Laos and Vietnam do. And there are other countries like Thailand, you know, doesn't want foreigners to control things more than, you know, is suitable. So there are a lot of oppositions for different reasons, but Cambodia is more permissive. So there's thousands of NGOs, and it's also a country with a lot of needs. So I put him there. So it is a place I've been twice. I went the second time because I had a scene in Phnom Penh in Bud's thing, and I wanted to sort of stop there. But when I started working on him, it was not too long after the election of 2016. And in fact, I had just seen the Spike Lee movie about the Black Klansman. I think that's what it's called.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And I thought, oh, I wish I could do something more political. I mean, this is so in my mind. So I gave him parents who were wealthy and were well off. An ultra-right wing. They were John Birchers, which was a big force, you know, in the years when I grew up, they were a big deal.
They got started in Orange County, where we are. So we are well-versed, yes, in the John Birch Society, yes.
Yeah, of course, they're still there. Yeah. But, you know, they've taken many, many other forms at this point. But in any case, I got him, you know, with parents like that, and I knew he was going to rebel against them. And of course, his rebellion is, I had, you know, Jewish liberal parents, but I was certainly rebelling against them also. I thought they were so conventional, of course. But so I, you know, I could use myself in, because people say, oh, he's nothing like you. Well, I haven't done most of the things he's done, but he's very much like me in a lot of his approaches to things. Mm-hmm. My favorite part in writing, and I have to say, so I got him to different, he runs away with a girlfriend because, you know, I had to figure out how is he going to get out, and I would have to make up these different devices. So when he's finally moved to a city, he's in Boston, and he goes to his sister's wedding, which is something of a reconciliation. He's been away from home for something like 6 years, and his girlfriend, as people did a lot in those days, I have to say, it's the 70s, starts preaching about, you know, how the help isn't paid well enough, or who are catering the wedding or whatever. I mean, we don't hear her words, but she's made herself very annoying and they're asked to leave. So when he sees his sister a few years after that, she kind of bugs him about that and talks about, you know, his political attitudes. And he claimed, although he is driving a cab for a living, he claims that he actually works for the union, and that's his job now, and that's what he believes in. And he ends up, after telling this tremendous lie, he has a friend who does that. That's how he got the fakery for his lie. But he ends up having the friend get him a job, and he works for the hospital workers union, which was a great union, for many years. But I loved it when I made that up. I sort of, I made up that lie that I then had him live out. I'm a writer. I can do that, you know?
Yes.
So that was, I was quite thrilled when I got to that part. And then I knew that he was going to have one of those, try this, try that, do this for a while, do that kind of lives. It wasn't going to be a continuous sort of form. So, and then, and I knew he wasn't a bad guy. I knew he wasn't necessarily reliable to those around him, but he wasn't a bad person, and that there were going to be lots of women in and out of his life. So then, you know, I kind of made it up as I went. And he's the one who's happiest in the end, I think. I love his ending. At the end of his sequence, he's thinking, he and Rachel have just, he's told Rachel about how he once robbed a building when he was, robbed a restaurant when he was young by climbing on the roof because he was a great climber. And she's very taken with that story and says, you know, I wish I knew you when you were a young hoodlum or something like that. And he's so tickled at that, that when he's walking along, Phnom Penh has three rivers that come together. It actually has a very pretty waterfront. But when he's walking along the Mekong, he's thinking, you know, I'm in one of these, I'm in a part of the world that I love, you know, a beautiful woman just said something wonderful to me over the internet. She just blessed me over the internet. I'm doing work that I believe. And if my father was still alive, I would tell him, you know, I couldn't ask for more than I have. So I'm sort of garbling this as I paraphrase it, but I couldn't ask for more than I have was a very important emotion I wanted to give him. And it's one that I've had, you know, at very happy moments myself. So I, you know, that was an important part. He was an important character to me.
It led me to wonder if happiness is a generational thing. You know, if certain generations define happiness, they certainly define success by different things. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering, certainly your definition of happiness changes at different points in your life as you want different things. And I do think it kind of changes from generation to generation about, you know, what we define happiness as, what we define success as. And yes, that was such a poignant chapter about what we're looking for and what our prior generation was looking for and looking for something in opposition to that. Yeah, there was just so much there. And he was such a wonderful, wonderful character. So you came to understand him and understand his journey. Was it a lot of dead ends? Like you would try something and back him out of it? Or he just kind of unfolded as he unfolded pretty naturally?
Oh, there's always dead ends. There's always, I feel like the entire writing process is trial and error. And you have to have some tolerance for that to be a writer. I don't know anybody who just sits down and writes it as if it were dictated from above.
Sure.
So there were lots of wrong guesses for him, sure, you know, or implausible things. I knew I wanted him to reject the inheritance. And in fact, I think that was probably more important in earlier drafts of the story. Yes. But I, because there's a lot of wills and inheritance in throughout the book, and I wanted him to take on that role.
I was going to say, I think money played a role, obviously, in every single one of these chapters, whether it was wills and inheritance, or it was borrowing money, or it was asking for money, giving money. That certainly was an enduring theme, the economic theme. I'm trying to remember that in your other works, if that kind of came up. It was certainly more in this book than others.
It's more in this book than others. And the second chapter was published as a story under the title Love and Money.
Mm.
I definitely wanted that. Also, because of starting with the father, the unfaithful husband, but money is such a factor in that, you know, which family is he supporting and where is it, although he has enough money, you know, where is the money going and so forth. So I knew that was going to play out, you know, I had that as a plot element, thinking of, you know, how do you invent what happens? So I knew things could, none of my characters are hideously venal. So the father feels secure in things he can pay for. He likes that idea, some people do. But nobody is like insanely grabby. You know, other people can write those books. But I did want it to be a factor in what everybody did.
Right. The other great thing about the Bud chapter, or, you know, it illustrated so well this play of time, going back to your book that you wrote about how to play with time. It takes place over a long period of time. I mean, Bud's life, I think it starts in the 60s or 70s, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a nice study in what you can do, how much of a character's life you can cover, and dropping in at different points of their life, how they have changed in a pretty compressed period of time. So that was fun too. It was just fun to see this character's evolution over a long decades of time.
I love doing that. That's one of my favorite things to do. And I like it that you can do it fast, that you don't have to, they don't have to sit and have a cup of coffee every time they have a thought, you know, that it can move along quickly and decades can be summarized and stuff. That's very pleasurable for me as a writer.
My guest this morning is Joan Silber. The book we are talking about is The Secrets of Happiness. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. There was a great example you gave of Princess Diana's life and how you can tell very different stories from very different points of view in her life. I wonder, can you kind of relay that as a technical, crafty anecdote to illustrate how to play with time?
Yes. My point was that a story is controlled by the amount of time it covers, by the duration of it, so where it ends. So the first story about Diana is, you know, she's this young girl who is very lovely and pretty, doesn't go to college, works as a teacher of small children, gets engaged to this guy who turns out to be, you know, the prince. And they have a wonderful wedding and she's pregnant soon after and has two children she adores. And, you know, if the story ended there, it seemed to have a happy ending. And then, of course, we know the rest, that she then, you know, there's trouble in the marriage. You know, he has someone on the side. She has her own affairs that, you know, they have a terrible divorce. And then, but she says, I will be the queen of people's hearts. And she feels that, you know, public attention is quite wonderful and is her defense. But of course, public attention kills her because she's chased to her death in a tunnel by an eager reporter. And the third story would be Charles's story. And Charles, I think, feels quite maligned by the public and has a whole other version of, you know, what the events were and his unhappy marriage. And he's finally with someone he loved all along that they apparently wouldn't let him marry. And it's sort of, and in his case, public attention is beside the point. So the message of the meaning of the story, but what the events seem to be driving at is very controlled by where it ends in time.
And it's a story that's still ongoing, right? I mean, you can see it playing out in Harry's marriage now.
Yes, that's right.
Follower of the royals, but as I was revisiting that Diana story, I'm like, wow, she's been gone for 20 some years and it's still very much alive. That story is still evolving. So yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just such a wonderful example of the ways fiction writers can come at something and it's kind of infinite. Who gave you the big problems in the book? Was there a point of view that somebody was a little bit elusive to you? Because this kind of kaleidoscopic way of looking at it, I love that you could, you know, Bud, who seems so biographically different than you, almost sounds like he was one of the more relatable characters to you. Yeah. And I'm always interested in that in writers who you'd think the person who would be the hardest sometimes is the easiest. And you might think that somebody who is so biographically close to you would be a little bit elusive. So I was wondering who gave you the tricky time.
The trickiest for me, because she was too pale at first, you know, there wasn't enough happening, was Maribel, who is, I think partly because she's an English character, so I'm faking it on that. Hmm. And I had her situation. I knew that she has an affair with a guy who's married. And then we know this before the beginning of the chapter, so I'm not spoiling it. He gets killed in a car crash. So what she makes of that, you know, she's not even the wife, so she doesn't get to keep that, you know, what she does with it. So I had this situation before I had her, and I had to figure out who she was under it and also what she changes toward as a result of that. So that took lots of drafts and lots of work. I was okay with it when it was finally done, but that was the one that, it wasn't that it was wrong so much as there wasn't quite enough of it, you know, when I first did it.
Do you think that's because, as you say, it was driven by a plot point as opposed to driven by her as the initial foundation?
No, because it was the plot situation that drove the first chapter and that went fine.
Oh, okay.
So it just depends.
Yeah.
I feel like that's one of the problems in teaching writing, you know, that these edicts that we would like to issue, like just go with your character, don't worry about the plot. You know, it isn't, you know, each situation is going to be different. There's going to be different things that give you a hard time as a writer.
Right. It's not like math. Too bad.
No.
So once you have a bulk of the writing done, I'm just trying to think of how you would organize all of the material, because it is very kaleidoscopic. You have a lot. I mean, by the end of it, you have six point of view characters, but you have a lot of characters. And so I'm wondering kind of, is there a, you know, is your office full of butcher paper and crime scene, you know, a piece of yarn goes from here to this character, so you can kind of see how all of the relationships flow out, or do you, are you able to keep this architecture kind of straight in your own mind?
I do start outlining after the fact once I get going, after the first three chapters, and then I'm drawing arrow. I'm doing just what you said. I don't do it on butcher paper. I do it on the computer itself, but I am drawing arrows and lines. And in this one, I don't think I changed the order of anything. I have in other books. But figuring out what the connections are and how I was going to use the connections. I think by the time I came to the chapter about Tara, who has a kind of distant connection to Gil, who's the errant husband in the first chapter, her mother was once a girlfriend of his, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to miss those connections. You know, I had to remind myself not to get too carried away in other parts.
Right. And at what point, I don't know if you have kind of a reading audience, kind of people that review the book with you. You had a lovely section in the acknowledgments that alluded to a conversation, you know, some conversations that you had with someone, and I'm sure your editor and publisher has a lot to say. But do you have kind of ongoing conversations about the book with either trusted readers or trusted thought advisors?
I have one friend who, my friend Myra, reads every chapter as I finish it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I discuss different things with other people, but she's really the person that I use. In this case, I did have my friend Chuck read the whole book when I was done with it because I couldn't get the ending right. I didn't exactly do what he told me, but what he told me allowed me to think of what I wanted to do. So there's that. So friends do help me enormously, but I don't want too many. You know,
right.
I don't want too much input. And my editor sees it at the very end. And then in this case, this book particularly, his input was very helpful. And in fact, one of the questions people always ask me is, oh, what about Treasure Island? It's this motif in the book. Mm-hmm. And I had Treasure Island in the last book. There's a valuable first edition of Treasure Island that someone has stolen in the last story and is thinking of selling for a good profit. And then in the beginning, there's a great mention of Treasure Island when Ethan's a kid. He loves it. Well, that the first mention was as a result of my editor, Dan Smetanka's suggestion. So there was some really wonderful, helpful editing on that one. My brother and I had a record that was a dramatization of Treasure Island when we were growing up. So that story is very dear to me.
Talk a little bit about Counterpoint, because they strike me as just a wonderful publishing house to work with. They always are bringing out really great stuff. Tell me a little bit about finding a good publisher, because I think you've been with several publishers over the time.
I've been with many because I've been doing this for a long time. My experiences with them have been nothing but good, I have to say. And at one point, Dan said something like, we're an author-focused house. And I thought, oh, what does that mean? But it actually does mean, it turns out it does mean something. He's a wonderful editor. He's very considerate. You know, he's very, I want to say everybody is very sort of natural and sincere. And they have an incredible publicity department. Megan Fishman, his head of publicity, is just amazing. When I was with other publishers, I really didn't know who did that. In her case, we're in constant contact. So they're just on it in a terrific way. I feel very glad to be working with them.
I kind of loved following your publishing history story because I feel like it's very relatable. Your first novel did very well. And then you kind of went through that thing I think a lot of writers go through, which is the second book was difficult. But you stuck with a lot of novels. And I was wondering if you could kind of talk about that, about, you know, writing through the doldrums, you know, to find the energy to keep going until you get kind of enough lift under your sails. And one question that I've been asking a lot of writers lately is whether writing is worth it for its own sake, how important publishing and success are to a writer and their work, or if the writing itself is enough to keep you sustained.
I'm so glad you asked that, because that, you know, my zigzagging career was actually very important to me. So I had what I always refer to as my 13 years in the desert between the second book, which had what I would call an underwhelming reception. And people didn't hate it, they just carried away about it. But there were 13 years when no one would publish a book of mine. And then I gradually kind of climbed my way out of that. That's sort of the short version. I certainly will, and I had stories published in good places during that time, so it wasn't completely nothing. But I would say I did think of giving up writing, but it was because it's so frustrating, you know? But it's sort of like saying I'm going to go eat worms. It wasn't something I could do. I did think of other things I might want to do with my life. I took a class in what we call American Sign Language, ASL. I was terrible at it. I'm not visual enough to be good at it. But I thought, you know, I could do that instead of teaching writing. Maybe that would make more sense. During those years, I became a buddy for Gay Men's Health Crisis, which just meant that this was the 80s. So, or the 90s, actually, when I started doing that, it was the 90s. I showed up once a week to help someone who had AIDS, not just HIV, AIDS. I mean, the people I worked with were really sick. And that was amazing. That was a great thing to do. And I did that for 17 years. I was also when I was getting, you know, everything, it was a hard time in my life. So I got interested in Buddhism, as one does when, you know, these beliefs I've been cruising on aren't going to last me a whole life. You know, what else can I find here? So in some ways, of course, it was a very fruitful time for me. I mean, all of the, you can't do that anymore, you know, try this, was very helpful. And I think helpful to the writing. I think the writing, I stopped, my voice has not changed that much, you know, in the 40 years I've been writing, but the way I write is quite different. I mean, certainly, and then when I started traveling, you know, this wanting to spread it over different areas and kind of want, you know, I always say I want it to be small and big at the same time, that I have, as I said, the soul of a miniaturist, but I wanted to fill a larger canvas. And I slowly developed this mode of, you know, as a way of doing it, the pieces that would tell different parts of a whole picture. So my publication history is connected to my development as a writer too, I think. But in answer to your first question, yes, I think writing is worth doing, whether it's meeting with outward success or not.
Well, and it sounds like once you found this, as I've come to call it, the silver method, once you found this way to weave the short story with the longer form, mm-hmm. that seems like when you kind of hit your stride.
Yes. Yes. That's what I think. I feel like I've done my best work in the last five books. Definitely.
Yeah. Right. And so that kind of answers one of my questions, which is in the early days, I know you were a waitress. I think you did kind of several different things. And I was wondering if all of those things tended to feed your fiction, because your characters often are, you know, kind of these bohemian people about, you know, they aren't the corporate money mongers. Right. And so I was just wondering how much of your exterior life, other jobs, odd jobs had kind of fed the fiction. It sounds like it has.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My long list of crappy jobs have been incredibly useful to me. And also, you see, I mean, one of the things, I waitressed for 3.5 years when I was a young thing in New York. And I always said, as long as I went to college and I learned as much. But you're really, that's a job where you're really watching people. You know, you're bringing them stuff, but you're standing there and waiting and you're overhearing what's going on at the tables and you're in the thick of stuff. I worked in a very sort of hip very hip restaurants that had a lot of sort of action going on. And it was in an era where there was, you know, a lot, it was the 70s. So that was very useful and very important to me.
I think every fiction writer should be like an Uber driver now or good stuff. And I would think the teaching would feed a lot, because the professor is kind of trapped in amber as the generations sweep through your classroom, right? You remain fixed in this classroom while generation after generation of student comes through, especially in the creative writing department, because they would bring in all of their various areas of concern that would change a lot as the generations change. I mean, when you think about transgenderism now, which wouldn't have been an issue, you know, 10, 15 years ago, which would have been sort of the coming out generation or the AIDS generation, I think, of 20 yeah. years ago. So, yeah, it seems like that would be generative material.
I love that. I loved, you know, you're eavesdropping all the time when you're teaching. I love that. And I love my students. I had some really, you know, wonderful students. But reading what they were writing about was really interesting. And seeing it change over the years. I learned a lot about what makes a story from doing it. Because it's sort of what's wrong with this picture, right? You have to figure out, how do I help them achieve the thing they want to achieve with this? What's it really about? What's it trying to do? And I feel like if I have one regret, it's that I didn't know what I was doing when I first started. And I think probably nobody does, but I did learn I did. It's sort of like people learn to hear form in music. I learned to see form in a story from looking at theirs. And that was great. I love that.
Can you say too much about another tricky topic, I think, for a lot of writers is dialogue, getting your characters to sound completely distinct and hearing their voices and, you know, finding their verbal tics. I never got confused in these stories of who was talking. And I don't know if there's anything you can say about that, kind of hearing a character's voice and how their character voice might be different from how they speak to each other. You know, their interior voice might be very different than their exterior voice. Yeah. But whatever you can say about that would be helpful.
That's what I love about fiction, actually, that we can hear the interior voice, you know, at the same time that we're hearing some exterior voice that's quite different. Certainly, when I'm doing the dialogue, sometimes I can hear them right away and I know what they sound like and, you know, but sometimes I would say that I touch up the dialogue a lot as I'm working, as I'm trying to get who the person is. There's a lot of finagling with little rhythms of it and trying to hear the different sounds and also probably who they're trying to impress at that moment, you know, or you know, where their kind of ambitions and attractions are at that moment. But I do go over it quite a lot. And I don't have it very long. I think that may be a rule that's probably true, that although great writers could violate it in a second, but the dialogue isn't usually very long. They usually just speak for a couple of sentences. And that helps keep the language distinctive also, because it's brief.
And it's interesting with the number of places that the characters are and live and have lived. You know, a lot of them are sort of living as expats or had lived as expats in different places. And I wonder, as you're visiting these countries through your own travel, I mean, do you kind of see these trips as research trips, or are you there purely as observer and then whatever seeps into the fiction later? I mean, are you kind of always taking notes as you're on these trips?
There's some places I've never written about that I've traveled. Like I've been to Japan 3 times and I haven't, and I love it, but I haven't been able to use that, partly because I think other people have done that quite a bit. Yeah. Or they were at the time that I was going. So it's kind of a back and forth. Sometimes I know I'm going to use it. I went, since China was the first place that I went to, I had already begun, I can't remember which came first, but I had already, oh, I know what it was. No, I had booked a trip to China and a friend gave me a book by Jonathan Spence, who's a sort of famous American expert on China. Of what foreigners have said. And there was a sequence of letters or quotes from letters written by a missionary wife who was in fact killed in the Boxer Rebellion. And I went and got the longer volume of those actual letters after I read his quotes from it. And that became an idea for a story that I wrote. So by the time I went to China, I was thinking, oh, what would the missionaries have liked? You know, how would have, I knew some from the letters, but you know, I could get things from it. And then I was in a provincial city called Luoyang in China. And we were watching people practice martial arts in the park, which I see in my neighborhood now. But there was an older guy who wanted his students, who were students in English, to practice with us. And we're chatting and he asked what I did. And I said I was a professor, because it confuses people, just that you're a writer. And he said, oh, have you ever heard of Oberlin College? I was taught by teachers from Oberlin College. Well, my missionaries were actually, I gave the school a different name, but they were actually from Oberlin. So he was a later generation. He had been taught by them in the 1930s, but he was a connection to the material I was actually using. It was quite amazing.
Wow, wow.
And he put me in touch with a colleague who knew more about Oberlin has a, you know, an Oberlin and Shanxi kind of, oh no, that's somebody else that has it. Oberlin has stuff about them. So, you know, I got more information because of him and because of his old classmate. So that was amazing. I mean, that was like, I made it up and here it is. You know?
That is very weird. Yeah, I love that. There was some other serendipitous thing that happened in another novel of yours. And I think we were talking about that last time. And I was like, I love it when a novel tells you you're on the right track. You know, you're doing
right.
I don't know. It sounds like a little bit of research went into this book because you hadn't Cambodia, right? Or no, you had been to Cambodia. You hadn't been to Nepal. You hadn't been to Nepal.
I had been to Nepal. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought I was going, so I was reading about it, you know, before I went.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about, so your research sounds very targeted to what you need. Mm-hmm. And I always am curious about you know, it's such a proclivity for writers to fall into the research rabbit hole and never climb out again, or at least it is for me. So tell me a little bit about your research process, when you know you've done enough, if you keep it really very limited and targeted to what you need, or, you know, if you're subject to the rabbit hole.
I'm definitely subject to the rabbit hole. I love it. But it's mostly in the beginning that I'm subject to it, because I don't quite know what I'm doing yet. And I'm kind of asking the research to help give me ideas. So I can't quite, in this book, it's, well, he does actually, for instance, in this book, there's one of the young men who are half Thai. They have a Thai mother and they have their father who was married to someone else. One of them, Joe, goes to Bangkok to bail out his younger brother who's been arrested for a quite petty offense. Well, I've been to Bangkok a bunch of times, but believe me, I have never been to a police station.
Right.
However, many foreigners have and have written about it online. So I don't know that, you know, I gave an exact, perfectly detailed thing, but I gave, I would say, a credible, you know, description of it.
Yeah.
And I have some sense of procedures. I totally made up how you would bribe someone. I don't know if that would work or not. And no one's going to tell me that. But I had enough facts to help me through that. So I'll stop when I get what I need, I would say. But the facts are also helping me think of stuff like, oh, they wouldn't do this. Well, then they do that. So maybe, you know, it's a kind of back and forth between the research and the story itself. But it's in the beginning that I do the most free wandering part of it. That's the more rabbit hole part of it. And then once I'm actually working on the story, I'm more apt to stop.
The other thing that you get so right is people dealing with addiction, or, you know, the outskirts of addiction, loved ones having addicts as people in their lives. And that's just a lot of life experience, I would imagine. But don't we all know people in that rabbit hole? But
Actually, the book I'm working on now has addicts in it, in fact. So I didn't, and when you, I thought, oh, I did that before, as you were talking. Clearly that's been of interest to me.
It's in the background. Yes, absolutely. Oh, we're drawing down on our time, but I wonder if there are things we should have covered that we didn't, advice that you like to give that we haven't gotten out there, things that are helpful and sustaining. Tell me a little bit about some of the stories over the years that you always love to teach and things that you think writers would benefit from reading.
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, the writers who've been most important to me are Chekhov and Alice Munro. I don't know that my students have loved Alice Munro as much as I have, to be perfectly honest. Mm. But that's really interesting. What are the stories I like to teach?
Do you think that's a generational thing? Are people, I hate to think people are growing out of Alice, or, you know, growing away from Alice Munro, but I wonder if she is of an age they can't relate to anymore.
No, that was true early on when she was a more, you know, contemporaneous writer. I think it's because the stories are long. I think they didn't always have the patience for them. But sometimes if I gave them something as highly charged as The Albanian Virgin, which is a favorite story of mine, I do recommend that. And it has a double story and it has a lot of exotic material in it, which is unusual for Munro.
Yeah.
They responded, definitely. But the thing about teaching is that each student needs something different. But mm-hmm. Chekhov is very useful because the one thing that he does that they're not used to seeing is he adjusts the narrative distance. So in the beginning, you think this guy who's being described is sort of a creep. And then you get closer to the person and he's the fellow suffering human. And then sometimes you pull away at the end and you have another view of him. And Chekhov is the only one of the few writers who can do that in a very short space of time. And I think that's very useful to see because it's so unlike what's expected.
Yes.
And what's taught.
Anybody else you love to teach?
Well, there are thousands of writers I love. I'm not remembering them so clearly at this moment.
Yeah.
I did teach the Colson Whitehead book that is now, you know, the Underground Railroad that is now.
Yeah.
On TV.
Yeah.
So when I've only seen the first sequence of it, but I had to read it at least twice to teach it. And it just, it's still, I love the mix of realism and not, you know, and sort of a magical telling of a real story in that I just think it makes it more profound without taking away the painfulness of it. I think it's an amazing story. So that was very useful. And I think students actually got a lot out of that. I've taught a lot of Edward P. Jones stories to good effect to people. I think people really learned from them.
His stories are not underappreciated, but I guess they felt overshadowed by the novel. And yes, I love to call out his short stories.
Yeah,
right.
You too.
Any last words of advice, wisdom, anything we should have said?
Well, I think that one thing I'm an example of is going against advice of, I mean, nobody thought that, you know, sticking together these stories and calling them a ring of stories or continuing to do linked stories and writing a novel that was sort of like that. Nobody thought that was a fabulous commercial idea. So I don't mean that I was actively discouraged, but I had to sort of figure out my own way to do it, anything to do it. So I would encourage people to maintain independence of thought, whatever they're doing. I think there's a big problem because you're told that you will grow by taking advice. Mm. And you will, but not always. So,
right.
So one thing that I feel I'm always telling, when I was teaching students, I was always telling them to, dig deeper and go for their, ask more of themselves. And I think that's very crucial. I think we don't ask for that enough.
I completely agree. Yeah, I think there's some inclination that there's either some, either it's our shortened attention spans with social media or whatever's happening to us. But I think there's this push to, I want to get published. And because, there was some satisfaction of going on the web and getting likes so quickly, people, I think, want that immediate gratification. And it's harder for them to hold on to things. I've found that people are very, not impulsive, but impatient for publication, and they're letting things go too soon is my sense.
Yeah.
If they'd sit with it a little bit longer and let it germinate a little longer, maybe it would serve folks better. But yeah, there is an impatience now to this generation. I feel it in myself, certainly. And it's, you have to resist it, I think. So that's great advice.
We were always impatient.
Well, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Finish your next one so we can do this again. This was wonderful.
Thank you so much. I have enjoyed this enormously.
That was Joan Silber. The book Secrets of Happiness is out and available now. That's all the time we have for this week. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.